Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace.
Well, today we're going to be updating the Meeting Drac section again, so just going in to edit the page, and as you can see for my San Francisco trip, which at the time you're listening to this will be happening in a little bit under a week, you can see I'm just going to be adding in the times and dates that you can come and see me. So I'll be on Red Oak Victory on the Saturday evening. That is, a ticketed event. Look at their website. And I'll be on USS Hornet for the rest of the weekend, pretty much. But as you can see, okay, this is a nice and easy text edit. But what happens in this text column if I want to add a picture? Well, just click away from it. You can see all the various bars open up. And then I just hit a plus, and I can insert an image right into the middle of all that text. Upload the image, and what is it? Oh, look, it's at the Meeting Drac page, so of course, it's me again. I'm going to be at the Britain at War Big Debrief Conference in Leeds, that's in the north of England, at the Leeds Royal Armouries. Just checking my conferences link works as well. It does, that's good, so I can go back to the Meeting Drac page. And, well, as you can see, there's quite the interesting lineup of speakers already. And then I hit save and exit, and literally that is how quick and easy it is to update a page with both text and images on Squarespace. The easy way to tell people about what you're trying to do.
So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakinafel. You can get a free trial, and once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show.
At the very beginning of the 1920s, the Royal Navy would embark on a series of designs, which would eventually come up with the N3-class battleships and the G3-class battlecruisers. While those may be of passing familiarity to most of you, and perhaps more detailed familiarity to some, the things that usually stand out about these designs are their thickness of armour, their level of protection relative to other ships that were designed at that point, combined with their heavy armament, and in the case of the G3s, the addition of significant speed. Of course, the thing that a lot of people immediately notice is that immediately after the very first pair of designs, dubbed the K-type battlecruisers and the L-type battleships, they moved on to various permutations on centralising the main battery, with the Ks and the Ls having had a more conventional layout, in an attempt to save weight and space, and thus allow them to get maximum armour, maximum speed and maximum armament in a package that was small enough to fit into at least some of the pre-existing infrastructure, as well as not costing the absolute earth. But what is somewhat less appreciated is that the armour scheme developed quite considerably as well during this period, not just in terms of where it was and how thick it was, but also in how it worked. And recently, I was lucky enough to be in the National Maritime Museum archives, which are somewhere in London, and while I was looking through the ship's cover, that is essentially the design history of the G3-class battlecruisers, there's a good section towards the beginning of that document that details all the alternate designs that came before it, starting, of course, given it's the battlecruisers, with the Ks. Now, just as you move past K3 and into the section where they're talking about the I series of battlecruisers, which would be the biggest of the battlecruisers that are designed and represented in the game World of Warships by the Tier 10 St. Vincent, which is why I'll be using a few screenshots of it during this video, because, well, as a design that was only briefly considered and then moved on from, and therefore obviously also never built, there aren't a huge amount of sketches of the thing, and obviously no pictures, I noticed an interesting little two-page section. And that contained a little diagram, which I've reproduced here, illustrating the proposed armour scheme for the I-3 battlecruisers. Now, in overall layout, it's actually quite similar to a number of different armour schemes proposed for various of what I've loosely dubbed the Alphabet 1920 series, but there are a few rather interesting things about it. It's moved on from the combined protected deck and belt layout that most World War I capital ships had, and a few World War II battleships as well, but that's by the by. But it's not quite what you'd expect from most 1930s treaty battleships either. It's got inclined armor. And okay, we know that the G3s and the N3s ended up with that. So the fact that this design also has it is perhaps not entirely unexpected. But you can see that instead of having flat deck armor that then meets up with the armor belt in a way that you might find on, say, an Iowa class, this has a flat deck. It has its inclined armor, but the two are joined by a slightly sloped deck that caps the main belt. Now, this is a type of armor layout that's not really seen anywhere else in capital ship design. And when you look just beyond the deck and the belt, you see that actually there's even more complexity to it, because on the upper deck, you can see there's a 2-inch upper deck armor, but there's also a 2-inch plate on the upper deck on the side. And then in front of the belt armor, there's a 1 3/8-inch thick plate. And then you have this labeling light tubes sitting in the void space between that outer hull plating and the angled deck armor. So what's going on here? Well, the light tubes are a reference to the torpedo defense scheme, although as you can see here, it has actually been extended considerably above the waterline. This is because in the late 1910s, and exemplified on HMS Hood, there was an idea in the Royal Navy that, yes, of course, as torpedo defense systems evolved, the idea of liquid layers and void layers had kind of come into play. But instead of having just a void layer, which is very good at dissipating the shockwave from a torpedo, but absolutely useless at stopping fragments and so forth, the Royal Navy had come up with this idea of filling said void area with what essentially looked like a giant series of postage tubes or scaffolding tubes capped at each end. And this was thought to have several different advantages. Firstly, any shockwave moving through this void area that's now filled with tubes is still going to dissipate because it's still an awful lot of empty air. But instead of passing straight through, the shockwave is going to have to deform and destroy these tubes, thus losing energy on its way through, plus any fragments from the warhead or the outer hull plating that are being propelled through by the explosion will have to cut through all of these tubes, thus reducing their overall speed, which is obviously a good thing because it lessens their energy. Hopefully they'll catch them. And it means that as and when the water comes in after the impact and there's flooding, any and all partially or fully surviving tubes that still have seal to them will provide additional flotation, because, of course, they contain air, and thus they'll become slightly positively buoyant, as opposed to just a pure void space where everything gets flooded and then you have some rather major issues. And incidentally, the buoyancy of the tubes was proven when Hood was sunk because a whole bunch of them floated to the surface. But nonetheless, as it turned out, after some experimentation, the liquid void multi-layer system turned out to be slightly better than having just a massive series of these sealed tubes. But of course, they didn't know that at the beginning of the 1920s. So the light tubes part, that's explicable because, well, between the outer armor and the hull plating is where you'd expect to find the torpedo defenses. But why are they going so high above the waterline? You know, the whole deck level above the waterline. You're not expecting torpedoes to be striking that high. And what's with these somewhat unusually thick hull plates? Well, it turns out the Royal Navy had come up with the idea of decapping the enemy's shells so that only the shell, as opposed to the arm-piercing cap as well, would strike the main armour, which of course would massively reduce the effectiveness of said shell and thus allow you to get protection against very large calibre shells with relatively thin armour compared to what you'd expect to resist such heavy shells. You'll note that the horizontal deck armor is 6 1/4 inches thick, sitting on a 3/4 inch plate, so notionally it's 7 inches thick, although effectively it's marginally thinner than that. And the slightly sloped section is 7 1/4 inches thick, that's sitting on the same 3/4 inch thick lower plating, so theoretically that's 8 inches thick, although again, for shell penetrating purposes, the effective thickness is somewhere between the two, between 8 7 1/4. And then the main armor belt is 12 inches, and it's inclined, as you can see here, at 25 degrees. That's 25 degrees from vertical, or 65 degrees from horizontal, which is what the diagram shows. The down angle of this upper slope plate, as again you can see, is 8 degrees. Now, this naturally invites several questions. One, Drac, how do you know this is supposed to be a decapping setup? Are you just, you know, coming out with this from your own ideas, or is this explicitly stated? Second, does it actually work if it is intended to be a decapping setup compared to, you know, something like, say, Littorio's, which I've covered in a separate video? And perhaps finally, what effect would this have on Citadel buoyancy, i.e. would the Citadel in this situation still be able to support the ship if everything else is riddled? Because, of course, there is this whole section on the right-hand side, in this case of the design, which will also be present on the port side, which can be flooded by shells coming in, where perhaps a more conventional slab-sided, purely horizontal deck-armoured ship would have that volume protected. Well, let's look into this. Firstly, did the Royal Navy explicitly state that this was a decapping design? Well, on the two pages in the G3's cover that actually deal with this, the first thing is it says, for full correspondence, see battleship cover page 71. That's slightly annoying, because the battleship cover, that is the cover for the N3 battleship, currently appears to be missing in action. We've only got the G3 one, which does occasionally cover some of the battleship stuff, but not a huge amount. However, what we do have on these two pages, apart from this diagram, which in the original is in pencil, is firstly, it says, Mr. Williamson, a modified design is being worked out with protection as above. Unsurprisingly, this comes just below the diagram. Will you please state the relative resisting capacities of the three plates when attacked by heavy APC shells at close and long range? Can you take into account the effect of the preliminary structure through which the shell has to pass before striking the heavy plates? And then on the reverse side is the reply correspondence from Mr. Williamson. And he says, Mr. Goodall, who is the Director of Naval Construction at this point, in the following estimate, I have assumed that the 2-inch thin plating outside the armour and the 1/3-inch plating plus tubes decap the shell. So yes, this is specifically being considered. This, in my opinion, is the only possible advantage you can expect to derive from it, and it is by no means certain that you would in every case derive this advantage. I find that against the 15-inch shell, attacking the side plate at an angle of descent of 15 degrees, the worst case, at velocities of about 1,515 feet per second, and attacking the other two plates at an angle of descent of 30 degrees, the worst case, at a velocity of 1,352 feet per second, you have limiting velocities for the plates, giving a margin of 3-5% over the velocities of attack, i.e. all plates are equal. They would all just keep out a shell at their worst attack. Against the 16-inch shell, it is considered that while the relative values are unchanged, there's probably some slight absolute deficiency between what the plates can do and what they would be expected to do. So there you have it. Yes, these were being considered as decapping plates, although Mr. Williamson says he assumes that the structures will work to decap, whereas at least in this correspondence, he doesn't appear to have done a huge amount of calculation to confirm that fact. Again, of course, the majority of the correspondence and presumably test results are all in this currently missing in action ship's cover. However, there are a couple of interesting notes. Firstly, he notes that, yeah, it'll work against both 15 and 16-inch shells, although he's perhaps a little less certain about the 16-inch shells. Although he does also say he's not entirely certain that you're going to get decapping as an advantage in all possible cases. So we can investigate that a little bit further now. But he also mentions two worst-case scenarios. Against the belt, an angle of descent of 15 degrees is considered to be the worst case. And you might think, well, why is that? Well, that is simply because of course, as the angle of descent gets greater and greater and greater, the effect of the angling of the armour gets greater and greater and greater, and of course the distance that the shell has to travel between the outer plate and the inner plate also gets greater and greater, and therefore the effectiveness of the armour increases quite significantly. But why not something like 10 degrees or 5 degrees? Well, for an angle of fall of that, the battle range would be so short as to be impractically close. You'd be talking about a couple of thousand yards, maybe slightly more than that, at which point no armor is going to give you any protection anyway, so what's the point of, you know, telling you something that everybody knows? But additionally, at extremely close ranges, of course, the statistical chances of hitting the belt become less and less. You're more likely to hit the deck. So a 15 degree angle of fall seems to have been considered as pretty much the inner margin for direct confrontation at what would be classified as a relatively close range engagement. And then you have the angle of descent of 30 degrees against the deck armor. Now, why is that considered the worst case? Well, you've got a number of factors going on. Firstly, with shells of the time, once you get beyond an angle of descent of 30 degrees or so, you're looking at very rapid drop-offs in the velocity of the shells. And since kinetic energy is half mass times velocity squared, the impact energy drops off significantly as well. Of course, later on, with super heavy shells dropping in at extreme angles, things change slightly, but that's a decade plus down the line. Another thing to consider is that an angle of descent of 30 degrees represents a range bracket of somewhere around about the high 20s to low 30s of thousands of yards, at which point the statistical odds of actually hitting anything are very, very slim. So this seems to be a combination of, okay, it's a fairly high angle of descent, so it's somewhat negating the relative thickness of the armor presented by the deck, but it's still got a relatively decent velocity to cause harm when it does strike, and it's at the outer band of what might be considered reasonable long-range engagements. And indeed, given that they're almost certainly talking about the 15-inch 42 gun with post-World War I Greenboy shells, the 15-degree angle of descent and the 30-degree angle of descent equate to around about 16,000 yards and around about 28,000 yards, give or take a little bit, depending on exactly what calculations you're using. So with that in mind, let's look at those two ranges, 16,000 and 28,000 yards, and see, would this armor scheme actually have worked, given what we know now about decapping and shell capabilities, against the most likely threats? So for this, I've gone for a worst-case scenario and assumed that threats are going to be either the 16-inch 45 caliber gun found on the US Navy's Colorado class, or the 16-inch 45, 16.1-inch 45 caliber gun found on the Japanese Nagato and subsequent classes. Now, obviously, on subsequent US classes, they would have been using the original 16-inch 50 caliber gun. However, for the purposes of the decapping calculations, the important thing is the diameter of the shell, and that hasn't changed, it's remaining a 16-inch. So if we reference this rather handy table, which is on Nathan Oaken's article Decapping Revisited on the NAV website, the main thing to bear in mind is down near the bottom. So we're looking for type 1 projectiles, because that's what these projectile caps would be. And you can see that an angle of impact below 15 degrees, we need a T over D value, that's a thickness over diameter, so thickness of the decapping plate versus the diameter of the decapping plate, of ideally 0.12 or above to guarantee that the cap would be removed. 0.105 to 0.12 is 50-50. And then above 15 degrees of impact obliquity, then we can say, okay, well, now we only need 0.08 TD value. So that's the first stage. Do we actually have the relevant TD value to ensure decapping of a 16-inch shell? Then we can move on to the next part of whether or not that actually means anything for the main armor. So as noted in the correspondence that they were looking into, you've got the 1 3/8-inch plate down by the main belt, but they say you have to take into account the tubes as well. So now, to be relatively fair, I've included only the effectiveness of the material that makes up the first layer of tubes rather than all the layer of tubes, but if we do that, then we discover that the T over D value of the 1 3/8-inch plate plus the first tube, either one that is in direct contact with that plate, is about 0.11. That's at 0.118, 11186, so 3 ones and an 86. So that is kind of in the mid zone where it's a 50-50 chance of it working at less than 15 degrees. And once you get above a 15-degree angle of impact, then it definitely works. If you account for the wall of the outer wall, that is, of the second tube, that would roughly abut the very, very first tube, then the value actually goes up to a point where we're well into our blue zone and we're definitely getting decapping. So we can say that, yes, the 1 3/8-inch section with the tubes will work. Without the tubes, it only works above a 15-degree angle. This will be important later. And for the 2-inch plating, the stuff that's guarding the deck armour, that's fine because just the 2-inch plating on its own returns a value of 0.12784, which at any angle gives us a nice, neat value that's well into the blue zone. But then we get into the second component of all of this, which is the decapping distance. So yes, you've knocked the cap off of the incoming shell, but is there enough distance for that cap to remove itself from the shell, or is it still going to slam into the armour essentially there and still do most of its job? This, of course, was kind of the problem that I highlighted as potentially being the case with the Littorio class. Well, fortunately, as you can see at the top, we actually do have a scale. It's a 1/8-inch to 1-foot drawing, and since obviously I have the original from which this sketch was produced, I can scale it all. Of course, there's no specific dimensions other than the thicknesses of the armour, which could be a little bit misleading, or more accurately, subject to rather major error, because obviously at this kind of scale, if you misread, let's say, the 12-inch thickness of that main armour belt plate by even the tiniest fraction, that's going to extrapolate to an absolutely massive degree across the board. But instead, fortunately, a couple of pages down the line, we actually are told that the amidships freeboard of the I3 design, and indeed the K3 and J3 designs either side of it, is 21 feet. So we know that the dimension from the LWL, the Legend waterline, up to the top deck there is 21 feet. So we can scale off of that. And that reveals to us that the distance between the very, very, very top right-hand corner of the inclined armour, so the absolute worst-case scenario, and the inner edge of the 1 3/8-inch plating on the outer side at a 12-degree angle of descent, which is roughly the descent angle of the Japanese and American 16-inch guns at 16,000 yards, is about 3 feet. And this makes a certain amount of sense when you consider that the tubes installed on hood, and therefore the types of tubes that would have been installed here, are just a fraction under a foot wide, so you get three rather than neatly stacked alongside each other in this area. Now, depending on which set of experimental data you use, the decapping distance, that is the space between the decapping plate and the main plate that you need to actually get the cap to come off, is between 1.6 and 3 calibers in diameter. So in the case of our 16-inch shells, that means our absolute minimum space we're looking for is a little over 25 and a bit inches, or just over 2 feet. Whereas, obviously, we have about 36 inches at the very top of the belt, which is about 2.25 calibers. So it's well above the absolute minimum, but not quite at the level of the 3 calibers gap, which would be 4 feet or 48 inches, that would be necessary if we were going with the absolute maximum necessary values. The good news for the scheme as a whole is that around about the time you get to the level on the armour going downwards where the word light is, so right at the top of the L and the I, that's roughly where the gap gets to about 4 feet. So the vast majority of the inclined armour at a range of 16,000 yards against 16-inch shells of the time has either enough or more than enough decapping space, even for the absolute maximum possible space needed. And as we said, just in that little upper band against specifically 16-inch shells, there's a little bit of a questionable area where if it's kind of the lower end of the decapping distance needed, as I said, depending on some results, it'll be fine. And the more and more conservative you get, the more and more it gets to a point where you're looking at it going, this may not necessarily work out. The flip side, of course, is that much as the Italians relied on the density of the foam concrete that they put between their decapping plate and their main armor plate to try and increase the level of resistance, which would decrease the distance needed, of course, in this, you've also got those additional steel anti-torpedo tubes, which increase the resistance that the shell and its presumably coming off cap is meeting as it passes through. So we established we're already sort of using the thickness of the first tube to bulk up the 1 3/8-inch plate, but that still gives us the second tube, or at least half the second tube and the third tube. So given that we're already about halfway between the minimum and maximum distances needed by test results, it's marginal, but I think it's probably just about going to work. Of course, with the deck armor, we've got 2-inch thick plating, which is great because that increases our TD value to almost 0.13, so that puts us consistently and comfortably well into the blue zone where we are knocking off those caps. And obviously for the vast majority of the distances involved from the shell going through that 2-inch plating to hitting any form of deck armor, there's far more than 4 feet, so that's definitely going to be a decapped shell. And interestingly, if you look at the area to the right-hand side in this case, i.e. closest to the outer hull, where theoretically you might get a hull penetration, which will then go on towards the deck armor, where that distance might be about 4 feet or slightly less, then you have this rather interesting 3.25-inch little plate on the horizontal and also connecting down from the behind the 12-inch plate going up to join it, which is providing that little bit extra resistance, which comfortably puts us back into, yes, this is going to be decapped. So great, our scheme works against 16-inch shells. It's going to decap them. That's obviously going to increase the effectiveness of the armor behind it, but is that effectiveness increase actually needed? Well, at the 16,000-yard range increment, if we look at the effective thickness, for the deck, it would appear not, because the effective thickness of the slightly sloped portion of the deck is just over 23 inches. And despite it being about an inch thinner, the horizontal portion of the deck, because of the additional angle that it grants, is equivalent to about 33 and a bit inches against an effective penetration value of the US 16-inch shell as found on the Colorados of 17.7 inches. So the deck's absolutely fine, even without that 2-inch plating. The belt, however, even with that 25-degree angle being 12 inches thick, gives an effective resistance of about 15 inches, which is, of course, 2.7 inches or so less. So without the decapping plate, assuming that both ships are side by side with each other, this 12-inch angle plate would be vulnerable to a 16-inch shell at 16,000 yards. But with a decapping plate in place, it becomes protected, which is obviously a good thing. And then if we step things up in 2,000-yard increments, we see that obviously belt penetration is going down because the shell is losing velocity, but at, say, 18,000 yards, the belt penetration of a US shell is 16.5 inches. The effective thickness of that 12-inch belt is 15.5 inches, so it's close to an inch difference, but the US shell would still get through. Then at 20,000 yards, now the main armor apparent thickness becomes practically 16 inches, and the effective penetration by the US shell has dropped to 15.4 inches. So at some point between 18 and 20,000 yards, probably in the low 19s of thousands of yards, just that sloped 12-inch plate becomes effective against the 16-inch shell. Now, of course, we're not walking ranges to closer than 16,000 yards, because that's not what the Royal Navy was thinking about, but it would seem to indicate that the decapping plate is buying this armor scheme just over 3,000 yards of additional protection, probably a little bit more as well, as compared to just having the 12-inch plate. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that if we go to the other end of things, to the 28,000-yard bracket, and here we'll look at the US 16-inch shell, because with its 28.6-degree angle of fall, it's considerably more dangerous than the 24.6-degree angle of fall on the Japanese shell. Here we find that the effective thickness of the 12-inch plate's gone all the way up to over 20 inches with a decrease in horizontal penetration of the US shell of 12.4 inches. Okay, so we don't need to worry about that so much. But if we're looking at equivalent horizontal thickness, because of the increase in fall angle, the main armor apparent thickness for the slightly sloped deck plate has actually dropped to just under 13.5 inches. It's still 14.6 for the horizontal plate. So while both of these bits of deck armor are just about theoretically capable of resisting the 28,000-yard shot from the US 16-inch gun with some margin, pretty much as the results indicated in the tests, decapping the shell and therefore significantly reducing its effective penetration is going to help quite significantly. And indeed, if you flip things around to deck penetration, the deck penetration of the incoming US shell is giving us 4.7 inches against horizontal deck armor, which, yeah, as you can see, is somewhat below the thicknesses of the armour that's on this armour scheme. And interestingly, if we look forward in time to World War II, assuming this ship had been built and had seen action at that point, then it's rather interesting to note that the default apparent armour thicknesses of the deck wouldn't be enough to stop a 16-inch 45 caliber shell from a South Dakota or a 16-inch 50 shell from an Iowa, at least with their later shells, but with the addition of the decapping plate, it is just about enough. So great, we've established that the scheme will work as intended against the worst case shells for the time period it's being designed for, and will actually retain effectiveness even against a lot of World War II era shells, although there is a point at the very, very top of the belt armour where things may be a little bit in question, depending on what gap you think you need for decapping behind the decapping plate, and of course what the absolute penetration capabilities of some later shells are. Minor issue, but generally speaking, I think we've proven that the conclusions reached by Mr. Williamson are, broadly speaking, correct. It's going to work. The question, of course, is it going to work efficiently? Because by the time you get to the G3 design, while they kept the angled belt armour, they'd moved to just thicker belt armour over the magazines, and all this complex notion of various decapping plates had disappeared. So why? You know, is there a weight penalty involved? Well, between the I-3 and G-3 designs, you've got to remember the G-3 is a somewhat smaller vessel, and I-3 is designed with 18-inch guns, with some notion that it might be facing off against larger guns at some point in the future, although the tests obviously done at the time were only against 15 or 16-inch shells. And of course, the bigger the shell, the proportionally greater an effect a decapping capability is going to have. But nonetheless, what about if they just used a regular inclined armor belt and a flat deck? Well, if we take this as a 1 foot depth cross section, because this is supposed to be over the magazines, and we assume that the outer hull plating is going to be cut down to 1 inch, because that's standard hull plating thickness, we're going to extend the main belt up to the level of the deck that is slightly below, and as a result, this 7.25 inch over 3/4 inch armor deck that's slightly sloped down at 8 degrees is going to be reduced to the same 6.25 over 3/4, i.e. 7 inch thickness that is present on the rest of the horizontal deck. And obviously that's also going to lead to the elimination of this 3/4 inch additional plate that's just at the very extreme right-hand side of the horizontal decking. Well, actually, it turns out this is the more efficient layout, because taking off all the various small thicknesses of armour saves us £956, or just over 42% of 1 ton per 1 foot of ship. However, extending the 12-inch belt up to the point that it meets the horizontal deck actually costs us £1,336. So we're actually paying an additional £380 or so per foot length of the ship in this kind of armour configuration to have what would seem to be the more conventional non-decapping layout. And that obviously is a negative, so there's no additional weight left for us to improve the thickness of the main belt to try and compensate for the fact we don't have a decapping plate anymore. Now, you might think this is somewhat odd, considering that, as I said, with the G3s, they did pretty much exactly what we just described as a theoretical exercise, plus they ramped up the inclined armour belt to 14 inches. So it's going to weigh more per section, or per foot. So why did they do that instead of this? Well, the only conclusion I can come to is that partially, compared to the I-3, obviously the G-3 was a physically smaller ship, and by playing around with power requirements as well as reducing the size of the main battery, it just meant the actual armoured citadel area that needed to be covered was less. So while the individual per foot length of armour plating may be heavier, you could spend that on essentially simple thicknesses of armour and still not go massively over budget on your weight. And calculating resistances for such essentially simple armour would be a lot easier and a lot more reliable at all kinds of angles as compared to the occasionally potentially finicky nature of decapping plates, especially if people were to rock up with, say, 18-inch guns or larger, at which point the thickness of the decapping blanks may not be enough. But whatever the case, clearly something did change, and unfortunately, as I said, the majority of the discussion further on this particular armor scheme seems to be in the N3 cover, which, as I said, is currently missing in action. But it remains an interesting what-if, and an interesting point in terms of consideration of this kind of protective armor scheme happening considerably earlier than the Treaty Battleship Building period. Thanks for listening, and see you again in another video.